Thank you very much. Honored guests, Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, Tun Dr. Siti Hamzeh, thank you for the opportunity to speak about the lawsuit that I currently lead in the United States. My topic is, where do we go from here? And so what I'd like to do is present a very, very small overview of the case, talk about where we are procedurally. I'll take about 5 minutes to do that. Once that's happened, I'll go ahead and give some thoughts as to how the case that I'm leading could be a what I hope to be a model for actually using the theory of aggression, which came from Nuremberg, and implementing it in not only courts in the United States, but courts all over the world. I think the theme of the topic, or the theme of my my speech, is basically that we have so much already that's been done for us as partisans in the cause of peace. And a lot of that work was done more than 60 years ago at the tribunal in Nuremberg against the defeated Axis powers. And with that as precedent, it's quite amazing, actually, what might be possible. And a lot of where I'm coming from is a student of Nuremberg, having learned about the Nuremberg case in law school, having studied it and read it now countless times, learning about the theory of aggression that was the chief crime prosecuted at Nuremberg. So much has already been done, and I think that the challenge for us here today now is to take that hard work and to move forward into new frontiers and to apply it in courts of law as we would with any other type of law. So first, just a brief background about the case. In 2013, my client, who is an Iraqi refugee, filed a lawsuit in San Francisco, California, in the Northern District of California, which is a federal court, alleging the crime of aggression. And the defendants in that case are the six highest-ranking Bush administration officials: George W. Bush, Richard Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and Paul Wolfowitz. So she is suing them in a civil case for her damages as a victim of the war, in much the same way that she would sue anybody for any type of cause of action. So to make it very simple, if George Bush had hit her in a car, for example, there would be no controversy that she could sue him if she were injured. And so it's a similar type of claim that we're making, is that his conduct and his actions caused her monetary damage, and under the American system, she has a right to seek her tort damages, her tort relief. And the basis of the lawsuit in the United States is a very, very old law that came from the first year of our republic in 1792. And that law is known as the Alien Tort Claims Act. And the first Congress in the United States passed this law to permit non-U.S. citizens, so non-Americans, the ability to go to the United States courthouse and file claims against anybody for violations of international law. So that's what you have to allege in order to use this very old law. And so what people have done for about 200 years, it was very common with piracy cases, for example. And recently in the 1970s and 1980s, people started to use it for claims of torture or claims for crimes against humanity. And so what we've done in this case is allege the supreme crime, which is the crime of aggression, as her international law claim. And what she's suggesting is that just as you could pursue a pirate under this law, or just as you could pursue a torturer under this law, you must be able to pursue the supreme crime, which is the crime of aggression against these six people who caused it. And as we know from Nuremberg, you don't get to sue the soldiers who commit the aggression, right? They're not responsible. The people who are responsible are the leaders who cause the aggression. And those are the people who are giving the orders, who are planning and executing these crimes. So we filed a lawsuit. The United States Department of Justice, headed by President Obama, moved to immunize these defendants soon thereafter. And they requested the federal court to immunize them under domestic law, under the basis that these defendants were acting under the scope of their valid employment when they planned and waged the Iraq War. We fought that certification for more than a year and a half, but unfortunately, in December of last year, the district court agreed that they were immune. and immunize these defendants from further proceedings. So what we've done is we've appealed that order, and right now the case is on appeal in the Federal Court of Appeal in the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco. We have a brief that's due at the end of next month, and what we're going to be arguing is a very specific point of law on appeal, which is whether or not a domestic immunity applies to allegations of aggression. Now, for those of you who are familiar with Nuremberg, you may recall this was the exact defense raised, or one of the defenses raised by the German defendants, who argued that everything they had done was valid under German law. And as a result, they couldn't be held guilty for something like aggression. There were other defenses they raised as well, but that was one of the defenses. And one of the things that we'll be raising here is that that issue was decided at Nuremberg, that domestic defendants do not get to raise that as a defense. Similarly, we're going to be citing to the Pinochet case, which is a case that came down in the late 90s from the British House of Lords, one of the most conservative legal bodies in the world. But even that legal body decided in 1997 that Pinochet was liable, potentially liable, and could not rely on his domestic immunity, which he claimed he had as a lifelong senator of Chile, that he could not rely on that to avoid the charge of torture that was brought against him by the Spanish judge, Baltasar Garzón. So we are going to be citing to that as persuasive authority on this point. And this is a very critical case, because this is the exact issue that we deal with. This is the issue that is, I think, the final wall when we talk about accountability of leaders, the ability for a leader to claim some type of immunity, right? So this is what has to be, I think, destroyed in our minds, destroyed in the minds of judges once and for all. Why should an immunity apply merely because someone was acting as a leader if the act in question was illegal, right? And that's a key question. In the last decade, many amazing lawyers brought similar lawsuits against Donald Rumsfeld for the torture, and he was immunized under very similar theories. Which I think was a very upsetting moment in U.S., you know, modern U.S. legal discourse. And so what we have to do is challenge that, battle by battle, step by step, proceeding by proceeding. So that's the background of the case. And what I'd like to do is move now onto concrete recommendations that, as someone who is fighting in a courtroom to make this happen, what I would like to see. Because when I brought this lawsuit, there was nothing institutional. You know, if I brought an environmental lawsuit, there would be 5 or 10 amazing environmental NGOs I could think of that I would call and get questions, you know, ask for support, and who might be willing to help me. If I was bringing a lawsuit about electronic privacy, for example, or freedom of speech, there are institutions and organizations both in the United States and worldwide that have data banks of research, that have authority, that have reputations, who would be willing to support that endeavor and to help bring a concerted movement and unity and solidarity to those issues. There doesn't exist anything like that for aggression other than this foundation. And this foundation is the first entity that's out there that has done a lot of the hard work in describing aggression, in gathering together the experts, in moving the legal research forward in terms of, because the last case about aggression was more than 60 years ago, right? So other than the Tokyo trials and other than Nuremberg, there hasn't been any precedent set on aggression other than this 2012 judgment. So what I'd like to offer are some thoughts as to how we can take this battle now on the offensive and go into courthouses, go find venues where we can try and do our best, and ultimately I think can, convince judges that this is the law, and to not follow it would be to not only upset Nuremberg, but would be to validate the defenses made by the Nazi defendants who argue that this type of law could never exist, that everything they did was completely legitimate, that what they were doing was simply following orders. And if those things don't give you a chill, you know they ought to, because these are the exact defenses that the government is making in my case, that everything that these defendants did was valid, that the court shouldn't scrutinize war making because war making is outside the scope of what the sovereign can be liable for. And this is a theory, this is a rehash of Carl Schmitt's theory of the exceptional sovereign. Carl Schmitt, who was the philosopher for the National Socialists, or one of them, presented a view in his one of his books called The Concept of the Political, where he argued that the sovereign can act outside the law and doesn't have to be accountable to law, and that a valid sovereign has every right to act in an exceptional manner, even if it's counter to the constitution or the grounding law of that country. And so that's the idea that we have to fight, that sovereigns or that individuals who become sovereigns can act outside the valid scope of what the laws permit. So that was the fundamental, that was the philosophical basis of National Socialism. And that's something that needs to be completely exercised from judicial houses and from politics altogether. So in terms of where we go from here, I want to propose a concept that comes from ancient Rome. In ancient Rome, you know, the senators were very ambitious, would battle for power amongst each other in order to gain influence in the Senate so that they could, you know, have more fame and glory. And the term they came up for that was something called auctoritas in Latin. And auctoritas, you know, or the modern English word authority comes from that, but auctoritas in Latin meant something more than that. What it meant was the ability to charm people and governments and judges and anybody to listen to what you had to say. So, for example, in the famous battle between Pompey and Caesar, both of whom were extremely accomplished generals who had conquered vast territories and subdued many enemies of Rome, there was a valid question between many of those Romans. Who would they follow? Who had the greater auctoritas? And that would, you know, enable them to command the Senate, to raise legions, and to ultimately fight for dominance in Rome. We can take that principle, I think, and apply it to kind of the idea space. And what we need to think about is how can we raise the auctoritas of this idea of aggression and the liability for people who commit aggression. It's not something, one of the battles that I have in an American courthouse is to convince judges that this is what the law is. So let me give you an example. If I were to file an intellectual property case, a trademark case, which I do a lot for clients, I don't have to tell a judge what the law is because the judge has seen this 1,000 times, right? So the judge knows the law. If I just have to display what the facts are and why I'm right. When I'm bringing this case about aggression, there's an additional battle because I have to unearth 60 years of history to educate a judge who probably has never heard about the Nuremberg Court and to tell them, you know, why Nuremberg is relevant, why Nuremberg is important. And that takes up half my brief, right? So it's already an uphill battle when half of my pleading has to be done on this educational effort. And so that's what we need to create as people who are committed to the idea of peace and committed to the idea that aggression is criminal. We have to create that backdrop already so that when a judge receives a legal complaint that alleges this aggression, there's no homework that we have to do. The judge already understands the language that we're talking about. The judge already understands about Nuremberg, remembers Nuremberg, remembers the principles about Nuremberg, that wars of aggression are not merely illegal, they are criminal. These are the holdings of Nuremberg, and under U.S. law, those are binding norms. That's binding law that comes in as a common law element. And so what I want is to be able to create that backdrop. And I would argue for three different things that international organizations such as this can do to help me and other lawyers like me in this fight to criminalize aggression. So the first is what I would call a proactive litigation approach. I think it's time that organizations committed to peace, you know, join the litigators and step foot into court. And it's time to actually take the battle into the legal courthouses. And, you know, just like with any type of litigation, there's going to be battles that we're going to lose. There's going to be motions we're going to lose. There's going to be courts that aren't going to like us. But fundamentally, there's going to be things that we can do and that we can win. And I think it's time, for example, that we reach out to those professors out there who are writing about these subjects and ask them to give us legal research, to put together amicus briefs. One of the things I've noted is that many international courts permit the filing of amicus briefs. So the International Criminal Court, for example, permits the filing of amicus briefs. The European Court of Human Rights permits the filing of amicus briefs. The domestic courts in the United States permit the filing of amicus briefs. And this is the way where we educate the judges, is by providing them with briefs and memoranda of law from distinguished panelists and legal researchers from all over the world to identify what it is about aggression that exists and how what it is, basically. And so one of the things that I think we can be doing is finding out what those venues are, where those courts are, what the rules are, and just begin submitting briefs wherever we can. Because even that, you know, even if the clerk reads it and not the court, you know, someone needs to be taught what these rules are. We have a giant education gap that we have to fill. And that's something that we can immediately do, is to start putting all this amazing research into a legal pleading and submitting that to courts wherever we can find them. The second thing I would propose would be, I'm just looking at my notes here. The second thing I would propose would be direct outreach efforts. And so what I mean by that is aggression is now, we have to make aggression a topic of conversation around the world, not just in courthouses, but also with NGOs, also with rights groups. And what we need to, what I think groups can start to do is follow and comment on other legislative efforts to criminalize aggression. Something that groups can do is to look at the protocol to the ICC, which will criminalize aggression as early as 2017, if that were to happen, and follow and comment on implementation of that. Follow and comment on other international efforts that may or may not be related, but that could help, again, educate people about what it is about aggression. The third thing that I think groups can do is to finally support independent research, and that's, I think, the great victory of the 2012 case, which was based in part on aggression, is to start moving the ball forward. The last court case about aggression was more than 60 years ago, and the international tribunals that have been founded since then in Yugoslavia and Rwanda specifically removed aggression, was not part of their jurisdiction. So we haven't had judges or justices actually examine law in this area in more than 60 years. So we need to support independent research so that we can talk about what aggression is moving forward, and talk about the legal bases of aggression that exist today, and use, you know, put it in the words of law, so that people like me can pull up those articles and cite that to the court to show that this is something that isn't dead, that this concept of aggression is alive and well, has never gone anywhere, and it's still part of our conversation. Something that I think, you know, would be interesting to do would be to think about successful groups like UNICEF, for example, which has been amazing in kind of bringing this conversation about the rights of the children internationally. And they have a very interesting approach where they might have, a master organization that is able then to create chapters all over the world to raise awareness about aggression. And I think, you know, some of the efforts with the children's clubs, for example, here are amazing, and a direct way to kind of increase the dialogue and conversation about criminalizing war. You know, this type of multifaceted approach, you know, litigation efforts, direct outreach, and then independent research, I think this type of multi-prong, multi-level approach is the way we have to proceed. And we have to be willing to lose a few battles, because that's the only way these things happen. You know, I've lost motions in this court. That doesn't mean I'm going to lose the issue altogether. It is a bit daunting, to be honest, but it's something that I feel important about, and it's something that I think a lot of lawyers, I think, would feel important about. But they have to know that, you know, sometimes when I'm doing this case, I sometimes wonder if I'm, you know, crazy or not, because there's no other research, or there's really no other resources there about aggression. And then what grounds me is thinking about the Nuremberg case, right? And I'm just pulling a lot of this stuff from Nuremberg. And my thought is, well, if this is what's holding Nuremberg together, then this has to apply in the U.S. court as well. You know, our law is so grounded. We have a concept again that comes from Rome. Something called the hostis humani generis is a concept that comes from Rome, and that concept is enemies of civilization. And so what U.S. law recognizes is that pirates, for example, are hostis humani generis. So they're enemies of civilization. Wherever pirates go, they destroy civilization. And our effort has to be to equate the people who commit aggression as pirates, as akin to pirates, as enemies of human civilization. Because that's in fact what they do. They destroy civilizations elsewhere, and then they destroy the civilization at home. And what we have to do is start to equate that together so that we can make those who commit aggression enemies of civilization the same way that pirates are. And we can start. We need to start using the same language like that. Again, these concepts are not, they're there, they're all sitting there. I think we just have to do a better job at packaging this stuff and then presenting it to courts. I'll conclude my talk on, you know, with those points, but I actually am very optimistic about the future. I think that there's so much work that we could start to do immediately, you know, starting today, that could have really amazing ramifications. I know that the world is sick and tired of war. I know I certainly am as an American, and I know that I'm not alone in that endeavor. I think the problem is that it's such a huge problem, it's easy to feel isolated, and it's easy to feel like you can't make a difference. But that isn't true. I think that, you know, good, committed people together can make a really amazing and meaningful impact. I think the comments this morning about slavery are so true. I mean, it really was just a small group of people, an incredibly small group of people, who decided that they didn't want to have slaves anymore as part of being a civilized moment. And that movement grew, and it took time. But today we acknowledge fundamentally that slavery is a horrible thing and shouldn't be permitted. We live in a very dangerous time where the high watermarks of civilization are coming apart. We live in a time when torturers are allowed to walk free without any sense of accountability. We live in a time where, you know, today, as we speak, there are civilizations, ancient civilizations, that are being destroyed by bombs and missiles without any sense of recourse, with blindness from the international community that is supposed to protect those types of things, and we have to have faith in the fundamental precept that the pen is mightier than the sword, that together we can make our efforts known through law, through research, through the courthouses, and we can do it motion by motion, complaint by complaint, you know, summons after summons. We can make this happen. But it's going to take a joint, concerted effort. It's going to take the ability to work together, which is the fundamental basis of any great movement. But I think if we can do those points and agree on a high-level strategy, I am very optimistic that the world will join this movement, because it's time for it. It's time to put war aside, and I think to live under an international community and an international regime where we can all live together in peace. So, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.